Tarry here, where the stories never grow old, and you hear something new every time they are told and it comes clear. So tarry here, where it doesn't matter your age, and when we gather round the table, we all take the stage year after year. So tarry here.
Welcome to the Enlightened Radio Storytelling Hour. At enlightenedradio.org, this is Fanny Crawford.
And Stash Ziolkowski.
And our theme today is Greatest Lies in History. And you have Mr. Ziolkowski to thank for this one. Today is Monday, September 18th, 2023. And we're so glad you joined us. Let's see what happens next.
All right. Here we go. How about if I make an announcement? Thank you to Andy Offit Irwin for that
Excellent. Wonderful
theme song that he has graciously given us permission to use at the beginning of every one of our storytelling shows. And it's his voice and his guitar and him playing. And it's wonderful and generous and kind of him to do that. You know, if we had to pay a license fee to use that every week, it would cost a couple bucks, I think.
Maybe somebody we should else. Start paying him.
No. Don't.
Like,
you would destroy him.
Like 10% of our income from this show.
Oh, yes. Okay.
Okay. Right. All right.
I say that. Now, tell us
about Speak, Stash.
Speak is having a great year. And doing a wonderful job presenting professional storytelling once a month in two different venues. It has been in five different venues. Amazing. Five different venues have been used for Speak this year. And that was because of a problem with the original venue didn't meet its requirements. And we just had a great program by Diane Macklin on September 12th and 13th. And she was the person who won the chance to do a special new story and to bring it into its livelihood and life in the September program. Next
was wonderful.
And it was wonderful. And I was sorry that I didn't get to be there in person. I think this is true that I have just gone the longest time in my adult life where I was not allowed to drive. That's, you know, 5 weeks, no driving. And it continues on until, after Friday's surgery with the pacemaker. And they have to say, okay, now you're okay, you're safe to drive, which I think is a funny thing. Because I have a nephew married to my great niece who got a pacemaker last year, and he had to have it fixed. He had to have it adjusted or fixed or replaced once and adjusted or fixed or something. And then a second time he had to have it replaced. And so I'm wondering about this adventure, especially because they place it under your skin on your chest. And I'm thinking, oh, they're going to give me a skin pocket. Cool. You know, so I'm really fascinated about the surgery. You know, they are going to put me to sleep. So that part I won't have fun watching, but I can imagine. They're always so nice when they give you drugs to put you to sleep for that. So Lynn Ford, October 10th and 11th. And on October 10th, she will be at the place I can never remember.
Reynolds Club.
Reynolds Hall. Right?
Yes, Reynolds Hall.
Reynolds Hall.
Right.
And on the 3rd, on the 11th, on October 11th, she will be at the Community Club, right down the street from the Reynolds Hall. And I'm looking forward to that because she's a great Afro-Latin storyteller, I performed on the same stage with her once in West Virginia, which was a thrill. I had her in Arkansas at my festival there, and she's a dynamite storyteller, and she tells great scary stories. So I'm looking forward to that. And then we'll wind up the year in November, the 14th and 15th, using the same two places, Reynolds Hall, which I remembered now, and the community club. Reynolds Hall on Tuesday, community club on Wednesday. It's November 14th and 15th with Bill Harley, one of the most popular storytellers in the entire country. I don't know, maybe in the world. He's a very great entertainer, plays the guitar, sings, tells wonderful stories, tells wonderful song stories, which I like. I've seen him a number of times, and the audience will be grateful that he's here. And that's it.
I'm excited.
Yes. And so are you going to tell about a big lie?
I am.
Okay.
I'm going to tell about a whole bunch of lies on one subject. Are we ready?
Uh-oh. I did graduate from high school. In spite of what they say.
Okay. On the topic of great lies in history, I'm going to talk about language. One category of lies regularly transmitted, even now, among otherwise educated and sensible people, is that language, usually the language in use at the time that the conversation turns to language, is that language is failing us, is in decline, or is in danger. Immediately following one of those statements, we hear outrageous and outraged arguments about how we as human beings in these degraded times are not communicating properly or well. It's often amusing to get people started on their pet peeves about speech and language. You can learn a lot about a person by encouraging expressions of opinion on idiosyncratic and regional speech habits. I had to close the window. There's two lawnmowers going right outside my house. So, two examples of these peeves are to listen to two English majors arguing about whether the fact that ain't is in the dictionary makes it a real word. I've heard that conversation several times. Or arguments about the annoying and relatively recent addition of so to the millennial vocabulary as the first word in any spoken introduction or paragraph or sentence or phrase. Many people seem to be under the impression that language refers primarily to the written word. In fact, the exact opposite is true. Language may be written down, but the writing process has always occurred rather late in the development of any language or culture. Language in its spoken form, speech, is nothing if not ephemeral, evanescent, transitory. Words merged with our breath and evaporate into the air. We find no amber-encased verbs or startled oaths hardened in the lava that took the speakers unawares. Some ancient peoples did preserve their written words in stone, wood, and papyrus, but that tells us nothing at all about the origins of spoken languages. That has not stopped humans, ancient and modern, from proselytizing. Here are five interesting tall tales that are current in the media for your consideration. Absence of evidence does not discourage speculation on the origins of language. First, the Bow Wow theory. The spoken word began as an imitation of natural sounds, an onomatopoeic echo of Ow. Boom. Ow. Splash. Drip. Now appealing in its way. But it's just silly under inspection. There are just not that many words that are onomatopoeic. And any foreign language learner will tell you that natural sounds sound different in different places. English-speaking dogs say bow wow. Spanish bow wows are guau, guau. In Japan, guan, guan. In Albania, hem, hem. In Korea, myong, myong. And Turkey, hem, hem. Not to mention, there are relatively few spoken onomatopoeic words, even allowing for differences across cultures, and that the majority of our onomatopoeic words are of recent origin. And the bow wow theory does not address how the structure and complexity of all human languages arose from simple environmental and animal sounds. Two, the ding-dong theory, or sound symbolism. This was championed by Plato and Pythagoras and asserts that spoken words were a response to the essential qualities of things in our environment. The first sounds evoked in human speech were in mystical harmony with the world around them. Some early forest dweller saw a tree and said, "Tree." Here's a quote. Sound symbolism tells us that teensy weensy itsy bitsy just sounds smaller than flopsy and mopsy. A chip sounds smaller than a chop, slits smaller than slot, and an old folk saying come down to us in English, many a mickle makes a muckle. Though no one says that anymore, and we have no idea what it means. What's wrong with this ding-dong sound symbolism theory? Well, no one has succeeded in convincing any but the few most impassioned believers of the inherent logic of a mickle or muckle of sound symbol connections. Three, the la-la theory of Danish origin postulates that spoken words came from sounds associated with song, love, and play. Now, I am not an accomplished singer, but I do love to sing. And this might be my favorite of the five language lies, that we as early humans learned to sing before we could talk.
Yikes.
Songs do have such emotional power. Happy sounds becoming words. Wouldn't that be cool if it were true? And my parents talked about a friend they had when they lived in New York before I was born. She made a commitment to never give her children instruction in spoken language when they were young. She only sang to them. My parents seemed to think this hysterically funny when they told this story, but I found it charming. My parents were always giving me instructions, written and spoken, but never, or almost never, sung. Maybe singing, "There once was a union maid who never was afraid," and "Lift every voice and sing, let earth and heaven ring." You know, the Black National Anthem really was a form of instruction. They were no longer in communication with that singing mother person by the time I was hearing the stories, and it never occurred to me to take notes or ask how I might, now in my dotage, contact the children of this person. But I wish I had. The arguments against the la-la theory, notwithstanding its charm and sweetness, is, as one linguist notes, the theory fails to account for, quote, the huge gap between the emotional and rational aspects of speech expression. Witness that singing mother. 4, the poo-poo theory. The poo-poo theory insists that language began with involuntary and spontaneous vocalizations, cries, groans, sighs, you know, OMG, yabba dabba doo. In spite of being involuntary, they express emotions and intentions and could have metamorphed to include words and syntax, thus becoming language. This theory does have some advantages over Bow Wow, taking into account complexity of modern language, and it goes on to explain how complexity might have developed from simple vocalization. But it does not provide any evidence, relying on guesswork about prehistory, way, way far back in the distant past, without any research. 5, yo-hee-ho theory, the yo-hee-ho theory. In this model, language evolved from the grunts and snorts evoked by heavy physical labor, rowing boats, rolling logs, running from saber-toothed tigers. The natural sounds arising from human exertion in collaboration with other humans might account for some of the rhythmic features of language and could have evolved into more sophisticated patterns that led to storytelling and coordinating group projects and activities. So yo-hee-ho theory might account for rudimentary communication elements, but doesn't get us very far in explaining where words came from, nor from there to wordplay, what happens when people talk. There are other theories besides the 5 lies I've bored you with so far. If you read the New York Times or Smithsonian Magazine, The Guardian, The Atlantic, or watch Al Jazeera, or even follow Facebook, you will see references to 3 other theories that I should probably mention here. The Tower of Babel theory, that all languages are derived from one original language, after which God, or we humans ourselves, initiated migrations that scattered humanity across the globe to different regions where derivative languages appeared. Therefore, all modern languages can be traced to a single source. Then there's proto-world history, which suggests that language arose independently in different cultures, proto-languages that eventually evolved further into many distinct languages. And this theory is supported by evidence from archaeological sites, with each proto-language spoken by a distinct group, but having similarities with other proto-languages due to contact between groups over time, many, 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 many years ago. But still, that doesn't tell us how language originated. And finally, Noam Chomsky's theory. Renowned linguist Chomsky developed a theory in the 1950s that humans possess an innate knowledge of language that is not learned from environmental sources, but derived from a universal grammar embedded in our unconscious. And thus every person ever born now has an internal ability to understand grammar, syntax, and vocabulary of any language, no matter your native tongue. The ability to learn and detect new dialects and languages remains the same. Chomsky is still influential in research on the complexity of human speech and the rich diversity that exists across all linguistic systems. Can you tell how fascinated I am by human language? It's so hard to pin anything down. Lots of stories.
Yes. And that was interesting.
all you can say, Mr.
Well,
Zane?
Well, you know, because you know, ever since I started paying attention to somebody speaking, I've listened to all kind of crazy ideas about how language came about and everything. And I think it's one of those things where people just have nothing worthwhile to do, and then they get onto something. Oh wow! I bet I know how the language started. I do have a question. Those dog sounds you made, where did you get those?
From multiple sources, several different books on linguistics, and from Wikipedia, and so, from several different websites. So a lot of them were repeats. I mean, I found the same words in multiple sources, but there were so many animal sounds, I just picked a few.
Okay.
And just a few languages.
So dogs in Japan don't bark like dogs in America.
That's what they say.
And how did they learn that?
How did the dogs learn it?
Yeah.
Probably from listening to Japanese people.
Okay, good. That's good. Good. I like that answer. That's a good answer. This would be one of those wild conversations to have in one of my chemistry classes years ago, where the assistant principal or my department chairman say, "Mr. Z, teach chemistry. Why are you discussing world languages and dogs that speak in Japanese?" And I would say, "Hey, because my students are interested." Yeah.
So do you disbelieve those sounds?
No, I trust your research. However, I would be willing to bet, if you could transport me to six different countries and there was a dog there, that they would be going arf arf.
Well, it would sound the same to you, yeah, because you have certain language in your ear. Apparently,
no,
other people hear
if you speak Japanese to me, I won't hear American.
That's true. But when you hear, well, there's two possibilities that have occurred to me, because I've been thinking about this for years. I've been reading and listening to linguistics CDs and DVDs for decades. And that is one, literally, and that is one of the first things I learned that really caught my attention, because it was a bit shocking to me that dogs would sound different to different people. So I forgot what I was going to say.
Well, the idea for the idea of a person receiving the sound would hear it in how they are used to hearing the sound doesn't make sense at all. If the dog makes a sound that's different than arf arf or wow wow or whatever, it can't change in midair and get to my ear and become an American sound.
No, of course not. But you are programmed with certain speech patterns, certain sound patterns in your head that you, because you grew up here, listening to people here speaking languages that are prevalent here, your ear is attuned to those sounds. So it makes sense that a Frenchman would hear a dog's bark as more nasal, because they use a lot more nasal sounds than we do. So their repetition of the dog's sound is going to include the sounds that make sense to their ears.
Wow.
Do you actually believe that? Well, I'm confused by what you're saying, because it sounds like either you don't believe that the dogs
sound different.
I think that the people hear them differently.
You cannot hear sounds differently because you lived in a different country.
The Japanese people whose first language is Japanese hear your dog bark and they hear what? What?
That's not possible. Sounds are made physically, and they can't be translated through the air into a new language.
So why do all of, I'm not saying they change. I'm saying that people's ears hear them differently.
Because of
how they're programmed to hear sounds.
I would think that is the worst kind of explanation I've ever heard.
So you explain to me then, Mr. Z, how and why 1,000 linguists around the world document that that's what people hear.
Well, I'm not a language person per se. However, I don't believe somebody from Denmark who says a foul word in Danish behind me will get the same reaction that if a person from America said the American version of that foul language behind me. The Denmark thing will sound like, huh? What is he talking about? But an American who says the F word behind me will get my attention and I'll hear the F word.
I do not understand what that has to do with dogs.
How can the dog sound get a different, be recorded differently?
It's not recorded differently. It's what the speakers, the human beings, tell the researchers they hear when a dog barks.
I believe what you're saying because you're saying it, and I know you've done the work. But to me, it sounds like the Duke experiment of the cards. You know, 5 different cards, and you sit over there, and you tell me, what card am I turning over now? And then they say, oh, well, he got 13% right. And
okay, I'm going to have to gather some linguists to have this conversation with you because I do not understand how your brain is processing what we're talking about right now.
Well, I hear language the way I hear language. It sounds just the way the person made the sound. Sounds do not change according to the receiver. Sounds are made by the person making the sound.
Why would a Japanese person say they hear whack whack?
I don't know.
If they didn't hear it.
Because the Japanese person may hear whack whack because they made that up. I'm talking about an American hearing a Japanese dog. They're not going to hear anything but whack whack.
Gosh, nobody ever said that an American dog hears that an American person hears a Japanese dog say that. These are what the Japanese speakers say they hear.
Right. Okay.
They write it down.
I believe the Japanese speakers hear whatever they hear. But an American person who doesn't know any Japanese would hear the same sound that they'd hear. They wouldn't hear anything different.
They can't change
the sounds.
They would hear bow-wow.
No, that would be physically impossible in this universe.
You're saying that the dogs actually sound different in Japan than they sound here. No linguist is saying that.
No, okay, maybe, but I would not. I say the dogs are saying what they say, period, and that's the sound you would hear no matter where you came from or how educated you were. You can't change the sound.
Nobody is disputing that. These are linguists reporting what indigenous speakers say they hear. They didn't ask the dogs.
Right.
They asked the people.
And indigenous speakers can hear whatever they hear.
That's true. They reported to arguing about if we both agree that this is what the speakers heard?
Oh, okay.
Why are you arguing with me?
Early on, you said an American would hear it as bow wow.
No, I did. I said an American hears a dog, their own dog, say bow wow. A Japanese person hears their dog, their own dog, assuming okay. that Japanese is
okay. I hear because that's not what I heard. I did not hear you make that
I'm
distinction.
I'm sorry.
It's okay. I'm really paying attention to you. I took notes. Look, I got a whole page of notes on this theories, bow wow and sound and all that stuff. I'm okay. really paying attention.
I will have to go back and read exactly what I did say. Okay. Sounds are different depending where you hear them. And what that means is there are different people in different places and they hear sounds differently. So the idea that that language originated with people reproducing small groups of people, because there were not millions and millions of people when language was developed, Now you're okay. Now we're going to go down that pathway.
What? No,
it's
I don't know what
for
to
you
say.
To tell a story.
I don't know.
You've
what
been
to say
listening
about that.
To an incredible conversation between yeah. Fanny Crawford
and Stasia Okalski, which I found fascinating. Absolutely, I really did. Oh, all right, sweetie. My wife is leaving.
I don't blame her.
Well, she just got in. Now she's leaving again. Okay, your session was 24 minutes, and part of that was also because of my misunderstanding. I misunderstood
24
what
minutes
you said.
Of me telling the story. Or 20
yes.
minutes, including our conversation.
Concluding the follow-up conversation.
Okay.
Yeah.
I don't need to know that, but okay.
Well, okay. Well, all right. So
because it could go on for it would go on if we were not on radio.
No,
still be arguing.
No, you are. I'm not arguing. I went by what I heard you say, and if I heard it wrong, I can be wrong. But what your first explanation was different than the final one to me. And that's only because of my hearing. Maybe I heard it wrong, which would prove some of what you're saying, I guess. You know, I don't know.
Tell us a story, Stash.
Okay. Well, see, I took this as in history and you know, language is always a befuddlement to me because I wonder, you know, very soon we'll have to deal with lots of changes in the language because of crazy people like Mr. Musk, you know,
mm-hmm.
He names his children with symbols and letters and numbers. And his children's names are not pronounceable unless you have him pronounce it for you. Which makes no possibility for other humans to reproduce that, because the letters and numbers and symbols in those names, and he's not the only person that's been doing this in the last, you know, I think for the last decade it's been going on, maybe even longer. People giving children names that you cannot read the name unless they tell you how to read it, you know. I mean, I've seen children's names on school rolls like this, you know, M2Y-0. How is a teacher supposed to come up with what that is? Have to ask a kid how to say it, you know. And anyway, so I hope Elon Musk doesn't buy the dictionary like he bought Twitter and change the dictionary into something that he likes. Anyway, the lie, the great lie that happened, that is a historical thing, is the Cuban Missile Crisis. Incredible lies on both sides until the governments realized and that a lot of this was due to, thanks to John F. Kennedy. In 1962, I got out of the Army at an active duty. And I was thrilled because I had gotten the idea from somebody in the Army and encouragement that I should go to college. And I wound up being able to go to college. A lot of people at first thought that was really great. I'm going to be the first person in my family to go to college and hopefully I'll graduate. And then I'll be the first to have a degree. However, my basic idea for going to college was I was done with the Army. I wanted people to stop telling me what to do and where to go and how to do it. And I wanted to play soccer. And so I wound up going to college. Okay, I was thrilled. 1962, I played varsity soccer at Mount St. Mary's, which ended 4 years later, played in every game for 4 years. I was thrilled to be on a soccer field. In October of 1962, I got a call from a sergeant, a master sergeant a first sergeant, which is higher, in Pennsylvania from the Army troop that I was assigned to as a non-active member of the military. And this sergeant informed me that due to the problem in Cuba, I was on 24-hour alert and I should make sure I have a bag packed, because if he calls me and says you have to report, I will have 2.5 hours. He figured the distance between my college and his base where he was talking to me from to report to him, to report to duty in the military because of my military specialist occupation. Okay, so, and the lie about the missile crisis was incredible, because at first neither one of the governments, Russians or the Americans, were telling exactly what was happening. Finally, an American U-2 spy plane discovered Soviet nuclear missiles on Cuba. Missile launch sites were being constructed. That was on 14th of October, 1962. On the 16th of October, 1962, President Kennedy was informed of missiles on Cuba. Kennedy called a meeting of his advisors. Executive Committee of the National Security Council was tasked with deciding what action to take. And the options that they looked at were invade Cuba, blockade Cuba to stop more deliveries from the Russians, from the USSR, which doesn't exist now, but did back then. Airstrikes against the missile bases was the third option. And the fourth option was don't do anything. Some wanted to attack, others wanted to negotiate. Kennedy decided to blockade Cuba, and American forces were put on high alert. I remember Kennedy's address to the American public and the world on television. He announced that there were Soviet missiles on Cuba and that the USA was blockading the island. Soviet ships were turned around before they reached the blockade, and that was in October 24th in 1962, Khrushchev sent Kennedy his first letter promising to remove missiles from Cuba if the blockade was lifted. This is, in my lifetime, I think this is one of the greatest possible bluffs that any American president has ever done. Because Kennedy made it sound like, if you come, we're going to blow you out of the water. He didn't actually say those words, but he was ready and willing to push the buttons. Before there was a response, Khrushchev sent a second letter. He made the additional demand that American missiles in Turkey had to be removed. Aha. And I wonder how many people knew that we had missiles in Turkey. So Kennedy accepted the first letter. Robert Kennedy discussed how to settle a crisis with the Soviet ambassador, Anatoly Dobrynin. I remember him. He promised that the USA would remove missiles from Turkey. However, this was banned from being announced to the public at this time because they didn't want to upset the Americans. All right? They didn't care if the Russians knew we were taking our missiles out. They didn't want the Americans to think that we had backed down from Russia. So American missiles were removed from Turkey. as we said they would be. And it wasn't announced to the public at that time. Under a secret government agreement, Khrushchev appeared to have achieved nothing. He was removed from power in 1964, partly because of that. And I do remember that as a really terrible, frustrating time for me, because I was so happy to be in college. I was so happy to be going to classes. I was so happy to be playing soccer. And the thought of me putting on that uniform again, which I took with me to college only because of the advice of one of the sergeants at Fort Meade, when I went kind of and did the official thing where I said, okay, I'm finished now on active duty and all that. And he said, keep your military clothes and your all your military gear that you left with near you, just in case. Probably nothing ever going to happen, and you can laugh about this in a couple years, but it's always a good idea, because if you get a call, and I laughed at that. I thought, nobody's calling me. We're not, you know, we're not going to war or anything. And unfortunately, it was very scary. I do remember putting the phone down in the office of the college, because they called me to the phone because it was an important call, as far as the sergeant said. So both governments were lying to each other and lying to the other and to their people about what was taking place. But finally, it got straightened out. And I was always happy that Mr. Khrushchev backed down. I felt bad for him that he wound up losing his position later, but apparently he was ineffective in a couple other ways that the Russian people didn't care for. And, you know, so that's, and who knows, you know, I don't know how you can read what the Russian people would think. I do know what the American people would think. And that was the lie that struck me first. And I do have another, if you don't mind.
Please go ahead. Fascinating. Okay. I remember that. I was 12.
Yeah.
It's one of those astonishing memories.
Yeah. And, you know, now it seems silly. I was, you know, there was nothing threatening in my environment. But I do remember my coach saying something to me at practice. I don't know if I was daydreaming or missed something or didn't do something, but he said, hey, get your head in the game. What's going on with you? And that was unusual, because I was always in the game. I was always in practice. I was, you know, but I had a hard time putting that thought out of my mind that I might be going to Pennsylvania in my uniform. Okay, so now the second thing that I think is terrible, one of the worst lies perpetrated, and I honestly believe this was done on purpose, even though they knew they did not have proof of what they were saying. George Bush decided to invade Iraq and blamed the 9/11 disaster that the United States suffered on the Iraqi government, because he said there was evidence of weapons of mass destruction. And that was a bald-faced lie. There was no evidence. There were things that suggested there might have been possible thinking about it, and we're worried, but there was no proof of weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. And because of George Bush's decision, and thousands of American men died, thousands of American service people died. There were some women who died also because of that. because of a lie. We should not have invaded Iraq. It did no good. It didn't make Iraq a better place. It certainly didn't make the world a better place, and it cost thousands and thousands of lives and a lot more Iraqi lives, a tremendous number more than American lives. And I think it's amazing that, you know, we had the Nixon thing with all his lies, and he paid for it. But Bush got nothing bad about Bush for declaring that. Nothing. In fact, he was reelected on the strength of him being a leader. I thought it was such nonsense that he actually flew on a jet and landed on a boat, and then declared that it was over. 100 days, he declared it was over, that war wasn't over for years. And we still have people in Iraq who are suffering because of that lie. So there you are.
Wow. You know, I remember that too, obviously. And being really blown away that people were not, that such a large percentage of the population, of the American population, of Americans, saw him as a hero when it was just the opposite. You know, it was. Yeah.
Well, it's unfortunate that. That our population, as well as the population of many other countries, at times follow their leader blindly, and until sometime after Bush was out of office during Obama's presidency or so, people started to really disagree more with the government, I think, and say things that were even worse lies. You know, the biggest lie in America is that Donald Trump was a decent president, and he keeps pushing the big lie that he won the 2020 election, and he has convinced thousands of people. I'm not even sure that he's convinced any of those people that he really won the election, or that it was fake, because there's so much evidence against that. But people want him to be president because they hate what Washington politicians have been doing for years. And there are no poor Washington congressmen or senators once they've been there for a few years. Their monetary value certainly increases. We have a lot of millionaires in office, and there are even some billionaires in office. And I don't know how we could ever fix that, because I don't think we can fix our Constitution, you know, in spite of what they say, that it's a living thing. I don't think that's ever going to be done. And so many of the people who followed Donald Trump believe his lies and just swallow it whole, even though there's absolute proof that what he is saying is wrong, is untrue. And I have a hard time thinking where we're going to go from here, because there you go.
I have a question.
Yes.
You mentioned a different lie, a different story or history that you were going to talk about. And I'm wondering if we could have a brief conversation. We don't necessarily need to talk about that topic, but I'm interested to hear how we chose our topics and all the lie, maybe listing of alternative lies. that we yeah. considered. But
right. Well,
mostly that because this was a surprise topic, and only a couple of days between the time when we agreed and today, having to deliver the story, I'm really intrigued by the process that we went through, and wondering if we should do it again or if there are reasons not to. I'm not sure either way, and I'm just interested in the process.
I don't know. I can't think of any reason to not deal with any subject.
Okay.
Unless it was something that would hurt. Something that would hurt a person completely innocent of any reason to be hurt, you know.
Sure. Yeah.
And the reason I suggested the topic was because of what's been going on. You know, we just went through 9/11 and the celebrations in honor of the people who died. I watched some of the celebration at different places, and where Flight 93 went down in Pennsylvania, memorial there, and at the World Trade Center site, and it's such an impactful thing that's still going on to people, 22 years later, and on the anniversary of 9/11, the thousands, almost, I think it's either just under 3,000, just over 3,000, because they include the firefighters, some of the firefighters who have died since then, some of the rescue people who have worked on that pile of rubble for weeks and weeks, looking for bodies, trying to find, people. And they read those names out individually, those thousands of names. And that has been on my mind a lot lately, how crazy, and we mentioned this, John and I talked about this. In fact, the last show, I would like to have a conversation with John probably another day, about, because I said war has never changed anything for the good, and John said, oh, I don't know about that at the end, I think, and I hope I'm not misquoting him, but I'm convinced of that. No one has benefited except the winners of the war, or the rich people who benefited from the wars. I just think we are a flawed set of creatures. Not only do our languages sound different to each of us, but we are a flawed species. You know, I am a firm believer that every human being on this planet is the same species as every other one. They might look different, they might sound different, but there's only one human species. There are no different species of humans on the planet. And I can't imagine why there are people who believe there are, and there are people who, in our country, who are convinced that certain people, certain, even what they say races, even though that's a big argument too about race, people of color, people from certain different places that are subhuman, and we have a government that has lied about that for well over 100 years, 200 years, starting in 1620 or so, about how the African-Americans and others were treated as subhuman, that they're not the same as the white human beings, which is such nonsense. And, but there are people who would string me up if they could get away with it, just for doubting that that's true.
I went yesterday on Sunday to church, as I usually do, to the Unitarian Universalist Church of Hagerstown, and the speaker was a pastor from another church, another Maryland church, and her topic was focused around a poem by the poet Rumi about human beings, ourselves, our persona being compared to a guest house, and the idea that we need to welcome every event, every person, every experience that we have in this life as an opportunity, as a way of exploring and experiencing life. And that's a daunting prospect in some ways, because lots of things that happen every day are not things you want to embrace, but it was
sure. Interesting.
And yeah. One of the reasons she chose that topic was she wanted to talk about Rumi, the poet, because he was writing from an Islamic tradition of hospitality and acceptance of the traveler, acceptance of the stranger. So apparently in his native tongue, was no word for stranger at the time. It was just traveler. And it was the moral obligation of every Muslim to accept the visitor to his home, to offer hospitality to anybody who came. And that was a long-standing tradition, not only within Islam, but within many cultures in the Middle East, partly because much of the environment there can be hostile, especially at particular times of the year. And early cultures would not have survived if they did not take care of each other in times of need. But much of her conversation, of the speaker's conversation, was about 9/11 and her reasons for choosing that topic. And I think she had a big impact on the congregation, on the people that were there, and each of us, you know, latched on to different aspects or were most happy about specific parts of the service. But one of the people that I know pretty well, who I was sitting directly behind, he speaks often, but usually doesn't speak much, just a few sentences. He'll usually update us on his life in general or say what's happening with him. But this time, when he had an opportunity to speak, he stood up and talked about being at ground zero on 9/11, and the people that he was close to that he lost on that day. So he was a firefighter at the time in Maryland, and his entire crew was transported to New York City to help with the rescue effort. And he had nothing political to say and nothing at all about Islam or any of the things that would occur to me when I think about that day. He was just totally absorbed in the memory. For those three or four sentences that he said, he was totally absorbed in the memory of being on the ground and the trauma of that day. And he was teary and very emotional as he just talked about what the day means to him. It was moving to me, and I had no idea what he would say. He's a fairly conservative guy, especially within our congregation. And his emotional connection, his emotional distress about even talking about the day was unexpected and a learning experience for me. So, you know, I don't know that I would have chosen that topic for that particular Sunday, mm-hmm. but it was an interesting way of approaching the event and the celebration, if we want to call it that, and thinking about all the losses associated with that and all the many lies that we face every day.
Well, yeah.
I'm looking at my clock. We're out of time.
I believe so. And
I'll close out the show if you're ready for that, Stosh. And then I think maybe John has something to say. Okay. It just appeared on our screen. This is Fanny Crawford.
And Stosh Steelkowski.
Your co-hosts for the Enlightened Radio Storytelling Hour at enlightenedradio.org. We are independent community radio broadcasting from Bolivar, West Virginia, Martinsburg, West Virginia, and Hagerstown, Maryland. The Storytelling Hour offers our listeners a window into the world of telling by traditional and non-traditional tellers, encouraging our listening community to share, preserve, and expand all of our stories. Thanks for listening, and stay tuned for John Case with Up Next.
Oh, with country music today on Mondays.